For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Taiwan is a country with a society and its own problems and perceptions that are always affected by, but not overdetermined by, the relationship with China.
The idea that being Taiwanese means being democratic is really socialized and institutionalized in Taiwan's national life.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Susan Dietz Henderson. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay respects to their elders past and present. Today we're going to be talking about the upcoming Taiwan elections. They're going to take place on the 13th of January and are arguably the most consequential for Taiwan since elections were first held almost 30 years ago and the most contested since 2000. Taiwan seems to be at an inflection point. The results will have implications not only for Taiwan's relationship with Beijing, but also, and I hope we can tease this out in our discussion today, how whoever is elected will manage increasingly challenging domestic, social, and economic issues while prosecuting its foreign policy priorities in the current strategic environment. The election results will be watched more carefully than ever by Beijing, Washington, Canberra, and the rest of the region. So to discuss all of this, I'm joined today by Dr. Mark Harrison and Professor Antonia Finane. Mark is a senior lecturer in Chinese studies at the School of Social Science in the College of Arts, Law and Education at the University of Tasmania. Antonia is an honorary professorial fellow in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies, specializing in Chinese history. Welcome, Mark and Antonia.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Look, I might kick off with you, Mark, if you wouldn't mind just providing us with an update on the state of play, how each of the contenders is faring. I know there were some pretty interesting dynamics around how Taiwan arrived at the final list of candidates. It went from 2 to 3 to 4 briefly, and now back to 3. So I just wondered, how are they all polling now? And I know that the predominant issue of the campaign is the relationship with Beijing, and I wondered if you could just give us your understanding of how they're differentiating themselves in that aspect of the campaign as well.
Yeah, sure. So we have three candidates. We have for the Democratic Progressive Party, Lai Ching-te, who is the vice president at the moment. For the KMT, or the Kuomintang, we have Hu Yo-i, who is the mayor of New Taipei City, which is the region on the other side of the river that used to be Taipei County, and we have Ko Wen-je for the Taiwan People's Party. So the DPP and the KMT are the two main parties, and the TPP, Ko Wen-je's party, is a new party, a minor party. I think it's fair to say that Lai Ching-te for the DPP is still tracking in the lead. And there's been a surge recently in the last couple of weeks for the KMT, whereas the TPP's numbers have been drifting downwards in the last couple of weeks or so. There was a moment where the three main parties and the independent candidate, Terry Guo, the industrialist, had to decide who they would nominate as their vice presidential candidates, and they had to put their names to register to vote on November 24, and that led to a degree of drama in the political process. But once and Terry Guo pulled out at that point, But once the VP candidates and the presidential candidates were chosen, that has sort of stabilized the campaign to a degree, and it's also tightened it up. So with the DPP and the KMT, their numbers have come together a little bit, and the TPP has drifted down in response. So at the moment, Lai Ching-te is still in the lead, and the KMT is has shored up its base with its vice presidential candidate and is tracking better than they were earlier in the year, and the TPP is not doing quite as well as they were a few weeks ago.
I was going to ask about the running mates that each of them has chosen and wondered if that's affected their appeal or not as we get into the final weeks.
Yeah, so for the KMT, Ho Yo-i is, as I say, the mayor of New Taipei City. He's chosen Zhao Xiaokong as his vice presidential candidate. He's had a long career in politics and in the media in Taiwan, going right back to the martial law period. He's a conservative political figure. He's very committed to the Republic of China as a concept, and he shores up the so-called deep blue base of the KMT, whereas Ho Yo-i is a more centrist candidate, and so that covers the base and a kind of and Ho Yo-i reaches to the center a little bit. The Democratic Progressive Party's vice presidential candidate is Xiaobi Kim, who is very, very well known in Washington. She's has just finished as the Taiwan government representative to the United States, but she's had a long and very diverse career in Democratic Progressive Party politics, going right back to the 1990s. And the Taiwan People's Party's vice presidential candidate is Cynthia Wu, and she is the daughter of a billionaire and is educated in the United Kingdom, and is an interesting figure as a not someone who you'd think would appeal to the South particularly, certainly would appeal in Taipei. So it doesn't really help Kerwin-te and his campaign in the South, but does bring a certain relatively young youth appeal. She's in her mid-40s. But if you look at the numbers, it hasn't really given Kerwin-te a bump. So that's the lay of the VP candidates.
Mm. And in terms of voter attitudes as they're looking at the various issues that each is campaigning on, Antonia, I wondered if you had some comments on what their respective advantages and vulnerabilities might be. I know that, the cross-strait relationship is clearly a crucial element of the campaign and this election, but there are a lot of domestic, economic and social issues playing into how voters are thinking too, which external observers don't necessarily look at in much depth because we're all focused on the geostrategic issues at hand. So I wondered if you could give us some thoughts on how you see their advantages and vulnerabilities being exposed in this campaign.
Yes, sure. Thanks, Susan. I'd just like to comment on the main candidates that I think that the three presidential candidates, an interesting aspect of them is that they are all from these local Taiwanese backgrounds, not even in the case of the KMT, which a party that has its organisations deep in early 20th century China, and we would expect a Chinese and mainland origin candidate to have emerged. Even there, they have chosen someone with deep Taiwanese roots, and that is a recognition by the party of the changing nature of the electorate in Taiwan, which just feels increasingly Taiwanese rather than even in a minority clinging to a primarily Chinese identity. So this Taiwanese-ness of the electorate, of course, also goes to the fact that Taiwan is a country with a society and its own problems and perceptions that are always affected by but not overdetermined by the relationship with China. So if we look at what they are identifying as issues of interest, the economy, which is not in a good state, is at the top of the list. People do usually talk about the economy if they're asked about, you know, what's important in the election. But there's an interesting, the economy embraces a lot of aspects of the society, including what sort of jobs are available, especially for young people. There is a high unemployment rate among, you know, I think the 18 to 24-year-olds. The cost of housing is a major issue in Taiwan. It's quite interesting looking at Taiwan from the perspective of Australia because quite a few common problems do emerge. But when you look at who is responding to what in this complex issues of economy and indeed of national security, we can see a bit of a gender difference. That is, in a long list of what should be at the a priority for the contending parties, we see males slightly dominant, as we might sort of expect from the stereotype, in defence, national security, cross-strait relations, legal reform, and women slightly in the majority in a whole bunch of social security issues, including, you know, childcare, aged care, jobs for youth, and so on. And this is important because women are very strong players in the political landscape in Taiwan. They come out in slightly greater numbers than men to vote. It's not a compulsory voting system. In slightly stronger numbers, I think for every cohort up to the 60s or 70s. And they are major players in local politics. So there's a majority of women mayors, which are sort of like mini governors in Taiwan. So we find the parties running policies that will speak directly to the women and their interests. And it is a feature of this campaign. And as you say, you know, the China-Taiwan relationship is dominant. The KMT's posters all run with, we don't want war, you know, peace on two sides of the straits. But in terms of how people vote, you know, they know that there are a lot of variables.
Any additional thoughts from you, Mark, on that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. There's issues around low wage growth, housing, childcare, aged care, as Antonio said, lots of domestic issues that people are concerned about and frustrated about. There's been some fairly solid policy statements by the three main parties around trying to deal with some of those themes. The DPP has a strong public housing policy. They're aiming to build more public housing. The TPP has a taxation policy that looks at reducing the taxation burden for families with multiple children because the birth rate in Taiwan is very low. And the KMT has a childcare policy that's pretty solid. Energy is another area as well that is perennial because for Taiwan. So Taiwan has excessive subsidies for energy from the government. It's very expensive for the government, very difficult to challenge politically, as previous governments have learned to their cost. But the KMT and the DPP in particular have zero carbon sort of goals to achieve, and they're hoping to use that process to try and restructure the energy market. So it's a very substantive policies on all sides. There's also a lot of quite strident negative campaigning that flies backwards and forwards. The DPP accused the KMT of having close links to organised crime. and they're not afraid to make those accusations. The KMT accused the DPP of being a kind of new one-party state and being interested in surveillance and control of the people. And so you get sort of multiple levels. You get some very aspirational messages, but then below that you get these very, very strident negative campaign messages that the parties throw at each other.
Mm. Well, speaking of negative messaging, misinformation, disinformation, there are reports, obviously, that we've all seen of such tactics emanating allegedly from the mainland to influence the election outcomes. And I wondered if either of you, perhaps Mark first, could discuss the role of disinformation in the campaign and maybe first specifically what those allegations and the evidence of interference from Beijing has been.
So Beijing has always sought to influence Taiwan's elections. If you go back to 1996 and the first democratic presidential election, that was the so-called third Taiwan Strait crisis, where they fired missiles and engaged in military exercises as an effort to shape the outcome of the election, very unsuccessfully, it has to be said. And more recently, the accusations are that Beijing uses social media, it uses it promotes stories and unsubstantiated accusations through the social media and so on to try and create division and a lack of trust in the democratic process. The Taiwan government has an infrastructure to try and combat those sorts of activities through removing things from the internet to they work very closely with social media companies to try and to suppress that sort of activity. I'm not sure that you could point to an actual election outcome and argue in recent years that it has been swayed by that sort of activity. I think if you look at elections in recent years, they're conducted in a very open and robust way. But I think the disinformation side of the electoral process creates a level of distrust and division in the political system, and I think Beijing is hoping to leverage that feature of Taiwan's democratic politics. It's not unique to Taiwan suffering that. I suspect after the election, whatever the outcome of the election is, it'll be a more divided political landscape, especially with the legislature, and there may be many fruitful opportunities for Beijing to promote that sort of activity. If the Democratic Progressive Party doesn't have a majority in the legislature, for example, that'll be a much more divided political landscape, and that will be a very fruitful landscape for Beijing in terms of trying to create a division where division might not necessarily really be organically there.
Mm. Any additional thoughts from you, Antonio, on this?
Well, I only know what I read in the news, Susan, but it is quite interesting in light of what Mark has just said about this sort of the disruptive effects of these news within Taiwanese society, creating an atmosphere of distrust and uncertainty. So the level of cyber attacks from China on Taiwan is a matter of record. I think it's something like 15,000 per second cyber attacks from China in Taiwan. But interesting for me is the number of inquiries, judicial sort of legal inquiries into relations with China at this time. For example, 141 chefs have recently returned to Taiwan from China, and they have been investigated because of subsidy on the Chinese side of their trips. So the question arises of whether they've been the recipients of junkets and will they, for that reason, be inclined to spread, local information favourable to China as opposed to Taiwan. There are quite a lot of these inquiries going on, which, yes, is indeed likely to create this sort of sense of uncertainty within Taiwan. It's not really easy place to be in terms of the relationship between the two places. So we have, you know, some quite blue, some quite KMT mayors who have recently on their own bat been going to China to try and rebuild ties, economic and cultural. It's quite difficult for the ruling party coming up to the election to manage these sort of relationships. Yeah, I would say that it makes for a very confusing situation psychologically as we head towards the election.
Well, I want to turn to the cross-strait relationship post-election in a minute, but just a general, I wondered if I could have your general comments on Taiwan's democratic processes, if you like. I mean, when we look at the region we're in, the Australia's region, there's sometimes concerns expressed about democratic backsliding or the illiberal character of some regional democracies. How would you think Taiwan ranks as a democratic policy in terms of the quality of its processes and institutions and its respect for the sorts of freedoms that, you know, we take for granted or we hold in high place, in a high regard in Australia?
I would start and say that I think there's a profound commitment in Taiwan to those features of Taiwan's democracy, because the democracy struggle was such a long one. So it goes right back to the beginning of the 20th century into the Japanese colonial period. It's many, many, many decades of struggle by the Taiwanese to achieve democracy. I think there's the idea that being Taiwanese means being democratic is really socialized and institutionalized in Taiwan's national life. And it's a very acute commitment. And I don't think there is it's also generational, because there's plenty of people in Taiwan's public life who remember the authoritarian period, who grew up in the authoritarian period. And so for them, there's a very acute understanding of what is at stake, and there is no complacency. How the authoritarian period is remembered and how it is spoken about can vary depending on where people sit on the political spectrum. I think there's been a long process of coming to terms with authoritarianism, really 30 years since the end of martial law and so on, more than 30 years now. And so it's been a very long process, but it's been an incredibly intense and foregrounded one. Just everywhere in Taiwan are reflections upon the transition from authoritarianism to democracy. So there's no complacency. I think in Australia we sometimes take it for granted a little bit, and that creates vulnerabilities. But for the Taiwanese, in the main, absolutely not. It's very strong.
If I could add to that, Susan, I just find this to be a very admirable society from the way in which it has developed these strong institutions and reflects in an everyday way the benefits of an open democratic society. So the first time I went to Taiwan was 1979. I was doing my PhD, and it was a very unhappy place. That was the year in which Taiwan lost recognition from the United States as the seat of the government of China. It became an outsider in terms of the international order. It is now recognized, of course, by very few countries. In that year, a very difficult and unhappy place. Going to Taiwan now, of course, you do have this shadow of war. You do have jets scrambling, but a wonderfully easy, relaxed, open place to be. And I feel as though this is, you know, deeply grounded in their ability to say what they want, to vote how they want, and to be supported in this by the institutions that have been put in place over their period since the 1980s. Watching the actual political process is great. You know, the sort of talking from the stump on street corners. Very, very interesting, engaging to see.
We'll be right back.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Well, it seems as if, as I said in my introduction, Taiwan is at an inflection point for, domestically as well as how it thinks about its identity to itself and how it sits in the global landscape. So coming back to the issue of cross-strait relations, given what Mark said in his initial comments about the positioning of the DPP at the moment, you know, obviously if William Lai Ching-te were to be elected, this would be the third win in a row for the DPP. And notwithstanding his signalling that he'll continue Tsai Ing-wen's, disciplined, non-confrontational stance on cross-strait relations and Taiwan's own status, shall we say, China will be worrying that this is entrenching a pro-independence government. So how do you think China's response will look like after the DPP win? It's already demonstrated it's not averse to military intimidation and other forms of pressure. Would it herald an escalation of that kind of pressure or even measures that hasten its pace towards unification?
So I think we can expect, and I know that Canberra knows this, the new government in Taiwan, whether it's a DPP government or not, to be tested by Beijing, both around the election and then certainly when the president is inaugurated, which is in May. There's quite a long gap between the election and the inauguration. So we could certainly expect some drama, military activities, perhaps a new round of trade sanctions by Beijing against Taiwan. Beijing will be trying to test the incoming government and test their discipline, but they'll also be testing governments around the world, including ours, and to what extent a new government in Taiwan has the continuing support of the international system. So they'll be looking for any kind of change in rhetoric from foreign governments as well as from the Taiwan government. Lai Ching-te certainly has a background in the south of Taiwan, in which he's associated with a less technocratic style of leadership than President Tsai. Obviously Beijing would be very unhappy about him becoming the president. One must assume that Beijing has war-gamed possible outcomes. War-gamed is probably not the ideal term to use, although it probably is true as well. So I think the question for the international system is whether or not a DPP win sort of tips Beijing into a different mode, as it were. So Beijing's is very opaque. It's very hard to know how they respond, how they will respond. But there are certainly plenty of examples where Beijing has made makes a decision, and that decision can be extremely consequential, very, very significant. It might not be immediately obvious that they've actually made that decision, but it may become obvious through the next year that, in fact, they've decided that they need to be dealing with Taiwan fundamentally differently, and then they may go on a much more challenging path with respect to relations with Taiwan. But I think that may not be obvious for some months. I think part of the problem is Beijing actually doesn't really understand Taiwan, I don't think, particularly well. And there isn't really a pathway to unification that would create any kind of stability across the Taiwan Strait. There's a reason why no Chinese regime or mainland regime in history has ever fully governed Taiwan in the last several hundred years. It just represents particular challenges. Taiwan has been on this pathway now for well over 100 years. And so I think Beijing doesn't really have a way forward to achieve its singular goals, and that creates a structural problem for the rest of the world to have to deal with.
I saw you nodding there, Antonia, when Mark was talking. What are your thoughts about this?
Certainly, I can see that the China will be using a DPP victory as a certain signal to which it needs to respond. But I also feel that they will look carefully at the actual results and respond accordingly. If I imagine a media response, for example, I think it is very likely that what we will see in the elections is a DPP victory in the presidential election and KMT dominance in the legislature, their parliament. So in that case, we will have a majority of KMT in the legislature with a president trying to control that. I think the Chinese media will interpret that as a very weak result for the DPP. They will try to minimise its significance and perhaps point to the fact that in the localities in Taiwan there's a very strong KMT, hence, you know, slightly blue tendency within the country as a whole. So, media response is likely to massage the results to minimise the significance of this third term for a DPP president. In fact, they will have to ignore the fact that all the presidential candidates on current showing are more or less likely to show the legacy of Tsai Ing-wen in their cross-straits policy. So any difference between the China-leaning side and the Taiwan independence-leaning side is being a little bit blurred and minimised by the fact that for the KMT now, the defence and deterrence are, you know, top of their list, you know, followed by dialogue. So it's not, you know, let's build trade relations first. They are all talking about defence and deterrence first. And that's very much the case across the board with the three of them. Now, the TPP leader has recently affirmed that he's basically on side with the DPP, with the government, on cross-straits relations. I don't know if Mark has a comment to make about that, but...
That's all absolutely true. There's a complicated political dynamic between the national elections and local elections. The KMT, because of its history as a party state during the martial law period, has a tremendous sort of ground game as a legacy of that, so it can really operate very successfully at local levels. It may be that this particular election, where that becomes clear is the DPP being successful in the presidency, but the KMT doing much better in the legislature than they've done in previous elections. Whether they'll get a majority, I think, is still uncertain. I think the TPP,
that's the third.
The Taiwan Party. People's Party. I think because there's a party list component to the makeup of the legislature, they may get quite a few seats. So it may be that no party actually has a majority, and that the Taiwan People's Party then becomes a kind of has a balance of power in the legislature. And I think this speaks to a much more complex domestic political landscape. Whatever the outcome, I think it's going to be much more complex. The two elements to that I'd highlight. One is that I think, as Antonio said, it speaks to the changes under President Tsai Ing-wen, that the norms, as it were, of what is considered sensible cross-strait policy have really moved a long way from the previous president, Ma Ying-jeou. And so the idea of, deterrence, strengthening defense capacity, strengthening the relationship with the United States, there are just sort of some now well-established sort of principles to how Taiwan conducts its foreign policy generally, but certainly with relations with the United States and with China. The second point is, if we move next year into a much more complex relatively less, how would I describe it, a more animated domestic political scene, I think that'll take a lot of work in Canberra and in other capitals around the region to interpret and to understand and to make sense of. I think it won't be... you won't be able to say, well, this just speaks to Taiwan going in one simple direction or another. It'll speak to a very complex internal political, domestic political dynamic. Australia's not well skilled in really understanding a lot of this complexity. We don't have a lot of policy capacity in Australia for making sense of this very complex domestic politics. And so I think there's an argument that we need to skill up to interpret the travails of the domestic political scene from whatever the outcome of the election will be.
Mm. Well, in terms of cross-strait relations and the potential for there to be pressure from China to ensure that the discipline that we saw around Tsai Ing-wen's attitude towards the independence question is maintained under Lai Ching-te's presidency as well. And obviously Australia's policy stance on this question is to, value the current status quo for all parties, especially in terms of preserving regional stability. In wrapping up, I wondered, given all that we've discussed about the domestic dynamics that are quite complicated in Taiwan, that perhaps external observers are not as appreciative as they should be, and how it might become even more complicated as we move into this third DPP presidency. I wondered, as we wrap up, if the both of you could give me your final thoughts on where you see the main risks and opportunities for Australia once the results are clear. I might ask Antonia to go first.
I think Australia has to bear in mind the regional complexities of the current situation, let alone the post-election situation. There has been quite a lot of talk over the years about Australia positioned between China and the US. The realities are that a lot of Australia's other partners, Korea, Japan, South Korea, Japan, and the countries of Southeast Asia are all involved in different and complicated ways with Taiwan, with each other, and with China. And the August summit involving South Korea, Japan, and the USA, you know, made this complexity very clear. So for Australia, I think it's never going to be a case of, you know, whether they're going to have to make a judgment between Taiwan and China and their relations with China versus their sympathies with Taiwan. They always will have to take into account the regional relationships of with which we are anyway deeply embedded.
Yeah, and I would follow up and say that we talk a lot about Taiwan in Australia, but we tend to talk about it as a question to do with the US alliance. So the phrase that we always use is, would we join the United States in a war against China over Taiwan? So sometimes we forget that there's 23 million people who live in Taiwan who will defend their island. And so I think we need to see beyond that sort of bromide around treating Taiwan as an America problem for us, and understanding that many of Taiwan's issues are actually ones that we share, that it's part of a very complex and changing configuration of regional relations and security questions, and that we can find ways to connect with the people of Taiwan, but also see beyond the sort of simple questions around whether this is a question about our relationship with the United States or not. So I think because we frame it very much in terms of the alliance, we tend not to see opportunities that may be there, and we could certainly mobilize those more effectively. I think there is a lot of actual interesting activity going on in Australia in terms of people-to-people relations with Taiwan. But ultimately, to see Taiwan as a place in itself and to see the bilateral relationship as a valuable one in itself is actually a pathway to seeing all of our relations in a more complex and nuanced way. And so that's certainly what I'd be calling for, to think about values, to think about culture, to think about history. All of those different features which are really meaningful for the people of Taiwan are also meaningful for us. And there's lots of connections there that we can make, which helps us see all of our relations in a more complex and deeper way.
Well, thanks very much for those closing thoughts from the both of you. And thank you very much for this fascinating and very enlightening discussion.
Thank you, Susan. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for the invitation.